WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
And welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, December 9th. I'm Dave Raven. It's great to be with you. We have a good show for you, chock full, I think we can say. Later in the show, we'll speak with two folks involved in implementing a D.C. law that supports 0-3 childcare and their caregivers, teachers. Really important issue, folks. And the compelling Voices for a Changing Middle East Festival is currently running in D.C. We'll speak with Ari Roth, founding artistic producer partner, Voices Festival Productions. But first, you probably have heard about the pitch battle going on across the country from here to California over the effort to withdraw congressional maps. It's all about who wins the House of Representatives in the midterm election next November. President Trump got the ball rolling when he asked, or maybe better described as demanded, that Texas redraw its maps, hopefully producing 5 more seats the upcoming election. The Supreme Court last week gave its stamp of approval to this move. California countered with a referendum that will allow it to generate several additional Democratic seats. And several of the states are in the fight on all sides of the issue. Maryland's effort to produce one more seat for the Democrats. It's crazy. This is national warfare, folks. And joining us to talk about Maryland's effort is Larry Stafford, a sometime co-host of this program and the executive director of Progressive Maryland. Larry, welcome back to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. My audio is messing up a little bit. I don't know if it's my Wi-Fi or yours, but I'm.
I can hear you. Larry, to whatever extent you can go on the visual, it would be great in addition to the audio, but we hear you. And we also want to hear from callers. This is Community Watch and Comment. We would love to hear your thoughts about this particular year from Maryland. 202-588-0893. Please chime in. We want to hear your thoughts about this craziness. Now I've got an alarm going off. I'm going to deal with that. So, Larry Stafford of Maryland, what do you make about what's going on across the country with this congressional district redrawing? It's kind of crazy, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. This is an unprecedented effort to rig midterms elections that I believe this country has never seen before, anything like this, actually. Not only did we have our current president engage in an effort to overturn the elections in 2020 with the riots at the Capitol, but now we have a more sophisticated version of doing almost that same thing, but with more forethought and planning, actually with the president putting pressure on legislators from various states, including Texas, Indiana, places like Mississippi, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, to gerrymander their maps in such a way to protect the Republican majority in the House. And this will not go without consequence, actually, because what we've seen so far in this administration is an administration that's unchained, reckless, and able to carry out its agenda without any congressional oversight or check on the power of the executive branch. And what Donald Trump is saying is that he essentially hopes to keep that going.
Right. And you've got a Supreme Court, what, with three Trump appointments that seem to be going along. I mean, last week they gave their stamp of approval to what's going on in Texas. I mean, it's a very serious situation.
Yep, absolutely. It's very serious. It has had great consequences for us here in Maryland. We just saw a government shutdown driven by the fact that, you know, this administration refused to negotiate on premium prices, which are set to surge massively in the coming days. And, you know, if there is not any kind of check in the House of Representatives, God knows what else we could see. We already saw Project 2025 being implemented for the most part with executive authority. But there's another half to Project 2025 that involves what can happen, you know, when they continue to be able to have power in Congress. So there are parts of Project 2025 that are still yet to be implemented that can only be done with congressional approval.
Right. For folks that might not be, on board with all of this, tell us what Project 2025 is.
So that is the long-term plan that I wouldn't even just say the Republican Party, I will say the institutions and the corporations, the bankers and billionaires that guide the conservative movement, what they have put together as a long-term plan to shape policy and shape the future of this country. Project 2025 is a step-by-step playbook for this administration to carry out an agenda that will change this country in a direction that we're already seeing in a lot of ways, with the crackdowns on immigration, ICE being ballooned into, you know, being almost comparable to a domestic military force, to what we saw with DOGE and the cuts of federal jobs as well. That is what we're seeing with Project 2025 already. And, you know, we don't want to see what may be next with more congressional power.
I mean, it's extremely serious. Project 2025 comes out of the American Heritage Foundation, and it's one of its chief proponents. I think its co-authors is Russell Vogt, who's now at the in charge of the budget committee.
Yeah.
Forgetting the exact name.
Budget. Yeah.
At the White House. What is the title? Do you recall? Anyway, it's extremely important, extremely influential, a Christian nationalist, something that we're going to get in, I believe, in our next program. I mean, it's extremely insidious. It's extremely serious. And then they've got sway, and the country is in serious trouble, I think we could say.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's a serious problem, and you've got, you know, Trump appointees on the Supreme Court rubber stamping this stuff. And if you look at the voting map, the electoral map nationally, I think, you know, in terms of this a redistricting war, the Republicans have the advantage, yes?
Yeah, they already have an advantage due to a longstanding structural advantage with power in various states. So Republicans have more trifectas in terms of control over both legislative chambers and governorships, and more states than certainly Democrats have. And so that puts the Republican Party at an advantage to be able to control redistricting processes in more states. And so that's why you saw the efforts in Texas almost immediately being countered by a very dramatic effort in California to redraw maps, because it essentially makes things like very difficult for Democrats to actually win back power, effectively rigging the elections, if all of the so-called red states, you know, do the types of redistricting that we're expecting.
Right. I mean, then this is, you know, it's very serious, because this is supposed to happen only once every 10 years, you know, with the completion of the census. But this is happening in the middle of those 10 years. And, you know, people of color particularly are disadvantaged with this mid 10 year decision on redistricting.
Yep, absolutely. And so some of the goals that the conservative movement still like plans to achieve, you know, such as, you know, reshaping the social safety net. You know, they want to make Social Security much weaker. They want to cut it back. They want to raise the retirement age. And they also want to cut back from Medicare and Medicaid, as they've already done, but they perhaps plan to do much further with that. And so in addition to that, we know that they have plans to put much tougher federal restrictions on abortion and women's reproductive health. And, you know, in terms of immigration, they are planning to, you know, get rid of things like birthright citizenship. And so all of these things need congressional approval. It's less possible for them to be done through the executive branch and executive orders. And so that's why this upcoming election is absolutely critical for Donald Trump, his allies, and their agenda. They recognize that and say they have to redraw the maps, because what they're seeing, frankly, is recently Democrats on the generic congressional ballot, Democrats are outperforming Republicans by 14 points on average. We just saw an election in Tennessee where a plus 20 Trump district was actually swung back to just a plus 9 victory for a Republican congressional candidate. And so that map, they know that effectively they can't really win fair and square. They have to actually redraw things. And so here in Maryland, we are calling on our legislature to be willing to stand up and actually counter these efforts on redistricting that are being done in other states. But as you know, we've run into an obstacle with our Senate president coming out and saying that he actually disagrees with the governor and the now former Speaker of the House.
I want to get to Maryland in a minute, but first I want to talk about nationally. You have a pending voting rights case in front of the Supreme Court that could really seriously blow the Democrats out of the water. If you could touch on that. This is the 1965 challenge to the Voting Rights Act that would allow extraordinary moderations of redistricting if it was allowed to pass. If you could touch on that before we get to Maryland.
Yeah, so in terms of the Voting Rights Act, like we've had this policy standing for decades now, protecting people of color from racialized gerrymandering. And now there's a case before the Supreme Court that could totally upend that. And so we're going to see the doors kicked off of the hinges in terms of racial gerrymandering in ways that we have not seen since, you know, the civil rights movement. And this is going to be absolutely critical for the voices of people of color across this country who are going to be stripped of representation in many cases. There are projections of losing dozens of Black representatives in Congress as a result of this, the stripping of the Voting Rights Act. And so we're in a dire moment right now for just Democratic representation. And I fear that, unlike, you know, perhaps the listeners of this show, many people do not recognize what's happening. And I'll add to this just for context as well, because I think a lot of people don't understand how democracies slide. And I've had conversations with folks from other countries who have effectively lost, you know, a sense of regular order democracy in those nations, in places like Turkey, for instance. And there are still elections, but it's widely understood that those elections no longer matter because they're effectively in one party rule. And that is the direction we could be heading in if we don't act.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have a, you know, people even are not talking about the Senate, which appears to be, you know, even with the upcoming election, likely to be in control of the Republicans. But, you know, the House is still in play. But if this Voting Rights Act case in front of the Supreme Court, I think it will come down, what, in June? Maybe sooner. I mean, we're in serious trouble. I should say with most of our program, and we would love to hear from callers 202-588-0893. So enough about the national picture, which is important and very dire. If you could go on to explain your Progressive Maryland, what's going on with Maryland? You mentioned that the Democratic, ironically, the Democratic head of the Senate is opposed to what the Democratic more is moving towards in terms of countering the Republican initiative to attempt to control the Senate. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, so in Maryland, Governor Wes Moore, as we began to see what's been happening in Texas and in Missouri and other places, Governor Wes Moore decided that he wanted to take leadership in the fight to counter these gerrymandering efforts in other states, with an effort to do mid-decade redistricting focused on creating even more fair and you know, fair maps that can produce competitive elections still, but help us to be able to counter some of the gerrymandering going on in other states. So he took leadership in that effort along with the Speaker of the House at the time, Adrian Jones. And now, of course, we'll likely have a new Speaker of the House, I believe, next week. And there was some time that went by where it was very unclear where the Senate president stood. And then just a few weeks ago, the Senate president, Bill Ferguson, a representative from Baltimore, Maryland, came out and said that he actually disagrees with the governor on this effort and, you know, actually wanted Maryland to essentially tie its hands in this fight. He makes a couple of different arguments that I can get into in a bit that I believe are actually not very substantial in terms of arguments. His role as the Senate president, you know, in blocking this essentially makes it a lot less likely for these, for this effort to pass. However, I know that the House is still very willing to pass new maps. The governor is willing to take leadership on this as well. He's created a redistricting commission to hear from people throughout the state. And the last hearing that we had, the testimony was nearly 3-1 in favor of doing mid-decade redistricting to keep Maryland in this fight. And so we're putting pressure on the Senate president and as well as other representatives in the state Senate to do what we've put them in place for. And there's a call across the country for Democrats to actually have some backbone to stand for working class people and protect the interest of everyday people here in Maryland and across the country.
Thank you. We actually have a caller. I so appreciate you checking in. If you care to say your name, we're calling from your question or comment. Thanks so much for calling.
Well, you're welcome. I'm struck by your gloom. I've been listening to you, and I hear nothing but gloom from you. You mentioned, however, the civil rights movement. Since the civil rights movement, it hasn't been this bad. It was worse during the civil rights movement. I am somewhat of a senior now, being 75, or close to 75 in another month, couple months. And I have to tell you that they had it much worse in terms of both political and judicial and all these other rulings. But people got together and set up spiritual and neighborhood and state resistance, and they changed things. I also have one other point. In China, they don't seem to have the hunger and homelessness that they have in the United States. When I was a kid, they had 4 million people dying per year. So I'm saying there's gloom, and I'm not quite sure why the gloom is so great, because they had things such as 2025, the plan that was coming out when I was a kid back in 67. The Heritage was sending it, and a lot of Democrats also received that, and a lot of Democrats also have supported those plans over the years. I hope people stop being so gloomy and so pessimistic and get another party that will actually do something and get the people organized, like the guy in New York, because we got 70% of people who don't want war in Venezuela, and yet it's going to happen. And we don't have people in the Democratic Party coming up for impeachment, calling for impeachment and murder charges against a sitting president and all sorts of hoaxes that he's pulling on the American people, and the Democrats are sitting back because they're run by the same billionaire class who we need to get rid of, period. I don't know, but stop being so pessimistic.
We're running out of time, and I appreciate it. I want to hear a response from our guest, Larry Stanford of Progressive Maryland. Your thoughts, Larry?
Yeah, I do take seriously what the caller is saying regarding, like projections of gloom and doom, and that is not my intention. And certainly I recognize that we have seen examples throughout history of, our Black people particularly and working class people more broadly being able to overcome even greater odds in more dire circumstances. And however, what I am trying to portray is that, we made advances during those times, such as the Voting Rights Act, such as the Civil Rights Act, and other policies that, helped to lift up and create a Black middle class in some cases. We've made serious promising advances. However, since those advances were made, there was a gentleman named Lewis Powell and a consortium of major corporations who came together in the 1970s, and they put together what they call the Powell Memo, that was a deliberate plan before Project 2025 to fight back against every single one of those advances. And they have made progress decade by decade, bit by bit, focused on eroding our civil rights, eroding workers' rights, women's rights as well. And so if we do not recognize the threat that we face, I fear that we can slip back into much darker times. And that is my effort. However, I do want to be hopeful as well, because we have seen our movement overcome far greater odds. And I believe in the power of organizing and putting pressure on those in power, as well as taking power in the streets as well, through protests and through having our voice heard and through getting a message out with programs like this to make sure that people stand up when we're under attack. And that's exactly what we're doing here in Maryland. We are asking folks to call on their state representatives in the state Senate, particularly, to say that we are demanding fair maps. We need Maryland Democrats who are in power in the state of Maryland to actually stand up and have a backbone. And that is what this effort is about, because we could be focusing hopefully on far greater things. Like, you know, the caller was saying, you know, I too look at places like China that have seen great advances in terms of technology from electric vehicles. They have great advances in terms of building out their infrastructure and raising people out of poverty. We could be focused on that as a country. Unfortunately, we do have two parties very captured by billionaire interests who are often unwilling to challenge the status quo. But what it's going to take to actually make those advances happen, to lead this country into a new century of prosperity, as we're seeing other nations develop across the world, is for us to stand up and fight for that future. So it's not ultimately about the gloom and doom, but it's a warning of what we could lose. And that is both what we have already and the opportunity to have even better.
We're going to have to end it there. We could go on. We're going to have to get you back. It's been great having you. I've been speaking with Larry Stafford, Progressive Maryland's Executive Director. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You have a great day now.
Appreciate it. And on to our next guest. In 2018, the D.C. Council passed the Birth to Three for All D.C. Act with the intention of creating an accessible, comprehensive early education and care system for D.C.'s infants, toddlers, and their families, including home visits and child care and development programs, in addition to early education that seeks to address the district's deep racial and economic disparities that remain present in early childhood. And joining us to talk about the Birth to Three Act, as it's called, is its current status, is Kimberly Perry, Executive Director of DC Action, and Michelle Stewart, a lead child development teacher in Ward 7, on the ground in the trenches. Thank you so much. We welcome 202-588-0893, particularly if you're impacted by this. Thank you so much for being with us. And I hope you're with us. Let's go back to 2018 and Kimberly, if you could talk about the original intent of the Zero to Three Act, as it's called.
Good morning, David. Hi there.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for having us on. Yeah, so great to see you and be with you. We appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to talk about an issue that means so very much to so many families in the District of Columbia, and that is the issue of childcare and early education. Probably the best way to start this conversation is by reminding you, because you were around, and folks, about DC being on the very cutting edge, leading the country in universal preschool. Back in 2008-09, we did universal pre-K. And at the time, advocates and Mayor Gray really wanted to also include infant and toddler care, but it wasn't politically feasible at the time, so it didn't happen. But about a decade later, in 2017, advocates began to write a piece of legislation that indeed would provide more public funding for childcare. So thinking about how to make childcare more affordable for families that have infants and toddlers, how to increase and improve the quality of care for infants and toddlers, how to pay the workforce more equitably, and also how to wrap around programs that families need, like mental health supports. And so that, in essence, is the Birth to Three law that was passed in 2018. Now, the catch is that it passed with flying colors in the council, but it was unfunded. It passed as an unfunded mandate. The executive office of the mayor didn't like it at that time. Mayor Bowser, she signed it, but she didn't immediately put funding behind it. And so that is how Under 3DC was born, to create a grassroots movement to ensure that the Birth to Three law could be funded and could also be implemented to ensure that we could make childcare more affordable and accessible for families in the district.
I mean, that's crucial. So give us an update on the status of that funding. Is it getting funded? I mean, it's very nice to have legislation that espouses these goals, but you need, you know, show me the money, if you will.
You got that right. Well, the interesting thing is that all these years later, Under 3DC and all its many district-wide partners actually have been able to raise over $216 million in public funds toward early education and child care. The challenge is that Mayor Bowser has put some money toward it, but not all. And then typically the council has to restore funding for those programs for them to move forward. It's been this sort of back and forth, push and pull between the mayor and the council when it comes to Birth to Three. Unfortunately, we're in a real pickle now, and families are upset and frustrated. We all are demanding that our child care subsidy program, which is part of this larger system of early education, as well as the pay equity fund, which is the fund part of the system that pays our teachers fairly and adequately based on their experiences and their experience in education, just like all of us in our jobs, is woefully underfunded. Mayor Bowser underfunded it in the 2026 budget, and then she eliminated it in the FY27 budget. And so we are calling on Mayor Bowser to reprogram existing dollars from the surplus to fully fund early education. We're asking for $9 million right now to reprogram for the pay equity fund, because if she doesn't put that additional $9 million back into the fund, it means a pay cut for many of our teachers, which no one deserves. They're doing the most critical work at a critical time in our youngest residents' lives. And so we don't want to see anybody have their salary reduced. It will cause folks to look for other jobs away from what they really want to do, which is teaching. We will lose educators in our early education system, and we can't afford that. That will mean that parents will have less childcare for their children at a time when indeed we need more. So that's kind of where we are, David. The other program that's woefully underfunded right now, too, is the childcare subsidy program, which is a mystery because there have been, I think 3 years ago, Mayor Bowser actually expanded the childcare subsidy so that it could provide financial support for the cost of childcare for more families. But again, she continues to underfund it year after year. So again, so many advocates, we are all trying to make the point to Mayor Bowser to put the funds into our early education system that are necessary.
Yeah, yeah. Michelle Stewart, if you could chime in, if you could talk about how this 2018 Act is impacting your experience on the ground. What's it like out there?
Hi, David. Thank you for having us on.
I appreciate it.
As a teacher that is physically within the field in our current time, I definitely was, like many, super excited to hear about the birth of the Pay Equity Fund. As a lot of teachers would agree, it's something that we felt like we could finally exhale on, as it was a much deserved granted salary over so much time spent in the field. And to see it kind of be in a state of possibly fading or even in a cut fashion for teachers is very disheartening. And from my perspective, the pay equity fund is, of course, a salary that's long deserved, but it is also a representation of the value that we hold towards our teachers when we do this type of work. I feel like this fund is important, not just to teachers, but to families also. And as we ask the mayor to allocate the $9 million need to preserve and keep this funded program alive, we want to further recognize that teachers are the pillars of early childhood education. And in order to uphold the foundation of education, you need quality pillars that require quality pay, which in turn gives quality care to children and families. And to keep that going, we need this program. We need this program to stay and grow with us. And I'm sure a lot of teachers can agree that it has helped them both personally and professionally. It has given some the chances to go back to school or stay in a safer house, to move their families from a trying situation to a better one. There are a lot of factors that stay in the benefit of the Pay Equity Fund. And I am very much active. DC Action is very much active in getting the support and getting the commitment from not just early childhood partners and educators, but from all educators, because this is essentially an educator issue also. We want to continue this work. We want to continue to represent that we value and need our teachers. To piggyback from Kim, we will lose our passionate providers if we do not keep this program stable and consistent. And that means a lot when we're educating the youngest of minds in DC. And so our message is urgent, it is real, and it is definitely heard. And we are hoping for the best, that the mayor allocates what we need to keep this program funded and to keep our teachers where they want to be.
Yeah, yeah. You've been hearing from Michelle Stewart, a lead child development teacher in Ward 7. And before that, Kimberly Perry, executive director of DC Action. It's such a exceedingly important issue. This is the future. These are the children that will go on to be full citizens. They already are in our district, and they need to be nourished, supported, and it's exceedingly important. The BIRTH to THREE Act from 2018 stipulates that no family should spend more than 10% of their income on child care. It raises the income eligibility of child care assistance, making child care more affordable. I'd like to hear from both of you. What would you say is the current status of that goal?
I can say we're about halfway where we'd like to be. As when the bill first passed, it's hard to remember now. I think the fiscal impact statement said it would take about $400 million to reach that goal that you just mentioned, David, of no family in the district paying more than 10% of their household income on child care. As you know, childcare is very expensive here in the city and in most places around the country. Most families are paying anywhere from $2,000 a month for childcare. It's like paying for college early. And childcare is often the second biggest, you know, financial obligation in their household. And so, if we can do anything to lower that cost and make childcare more accessible for more families, then we will be doing a good thing here, greater good for our workforce, for the education of our youngest learners, and for, you know, just a safer, more productive city. And as you said, more productive citizen. So we are about halfway there. As I mentioned, Mayor Bowser expanded child care subsidy, which allows for lower income families a little higher up the income scale to also participate. But unfortunately, she keeps underfunding it when there are more and more families who are learning about the opportunity and taking advantage of it. And so we've still got a long way to go, but we can't get there if we're not consistently putting the proper investment in and increasing it for inflation over time and increasing it as more and more families come into the system. You can't make a promise and then say, oh, wait, you know, I want to keep it at this dollar amount, and so I'm going to stop funding it. You have to continue to fund it as the need grows.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the bedrock of what the government need to be doing in terms of supporting our various communities. Michelle Stewart, if you could tell us what's happening in terms of financial support for early education providers. They need a decent wage, which was promised in that 2018 act. What's the current status?
With this program being funded, I would say that we have seen, from my personal gathering experience from fellow teachers, a growth in stability for the care of teachers and their families. There have been stability in payments. There have been growth in experiences and decisions to return to school and further their education in early childhood. There have been a number of things that has further invested in teachers because of the program bringing back their financial stability. It has grown their families. It has given them a sense of relief in that they feel valued enough and, you know, pretty much taken care of, that it allows them to live better than what they've experienced before. And what I will say to our halfway mark is that teachers see a high demand in specifically infant and toddler care. So like Kim said, our families are growing, but they all start young, and many young children are looking for care. So it is to encircle all of these things that we keep these programs running. We keep these programs strong and alive for all of our growing families and our growing communities. And serving low-income families allows flexibility for parents to return to work, to build a stable income for themselves and a stronger household for their young children.
Yeah. I mean, it's extremely important. It's kind of the ballast of what government need to be doing, and in my estimation, are both of you hopeful? We're running out of time, but are both of you hopeful about what's likely to happen? We have a, you know, departing mayor, a new mayor coming in at the end of the year, end of next year. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
As Michelle mentioned, the urgency is real. We need Mayor Bowser to act fast. We need her to act now before December 31st to reprogram dollars for the pay equity fund. If she doesn't, come January 1, our early educators will see pay reductions. Nobody wants to see a pay cut that's undeserved. Nobody wants to be out there looking for a new job when they really want to stay and do the job they love, teaching, educating, and caring for our youngest learners. So the need is now. We are calling on Mayor Bowser to reprogram these dollars. We also are calling on the council. The next budget period is coming soon. And so we are asking all of our council members to prioritize early education, to make sure that every part of the system is fully funded. David, we also do a lot of candidate forums during election season. As you know, the primary is coming up next June. There will be a race for the mayor, but there will also be several council seats available. And so we will be asking a lot of candidates their positions on early education and childcare. And so we will be doing a lot of education during that time and just making sure candidates as well as voters understand the importance of childcare and early education to our local economy, our workers, our families, and more important, our students and young people themselves.
Yeah, we're going to have to end it there. This is exceedingly important in my estimation. We're going to have to get both of you back. It's been very good having you. I've been speaking with Kimberly Perry, Executive Director of DC Action, and Michelle Stewart, a lead child development teacher in Ward 7. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
David.
Really appreciate it. And on to our last guest. The compelling Voices from a Changing Middle East Festival is currently running in DC. The series' initial play, a musical about the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in 1995 by an Israeli senator, just concluded, but there's more to come. We're joined now by Ari Roth, founding artistic producing partner of Voices Festival Productions. Ari Roth, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to see you here, David. It was great that you were able to make it to the theater for one of our closing performances.
The last time I saw you, we were cleaning up spilled coffee by yours truly.
It says a lot about both of us that we got down on our hands and knees and mopped up the mess before everybody could track all over the stage floor. So good for us.
You know, Ari, you weren't waiting for none. It was very, very impressive. You managed to pick bland, rather uncontroversial topics, a touch on the recently concluded musical about Prime Minister Rabin's assassination, if you would.
Sure. It's all part of our Voices from a Changing Middle East Festival, which has been running for 25 years. You know, I've known you for all that time when we started at Theater J and then moved to Mosaic. And then for the last 4 years, we've been newly independent at Voices Festival Productions. We're in residence at the church at 16th and S Street, the Universalist National Memorial Church, where Spooky Action Theater performs. And this year, the theme of the festival is how we got here, where we go next. And we're obviously talking about issues of war, peace, justice, and political violence. The Anchor production was this world premiere musical, 10 years in the making, called November 4, that really explored the toxic divisions within a society that we found DC audiences could really identify with, no matter what their religious or political background was. They could see the costs of toxic political divisions in our own midst, and of course, what's unfolded within Israel over the past decades, since the state's inception. Of course, it's been rife with divisions, just like our country since the very beginning. And, in this case, we were looking at the connection between 1995 and 2025, and how the war in Gaza, everything that was perpetrated on October 7th, in some ways grew out of the failure to achieve a peace back 30 years ago when Oslo 1 and Oslo 2 were on the table.
Yeah, I mean, it's very compelling. And I remember the moment when I heard that Prime Minister Rabin had been assassinated. And he wasn't assassinated by a Palestinian. He was assassinated by an Israeli Jewish settler. I mean, it's rather daunting. Tragic.
Much like the situation 2 years and 3 months ago with October 7th, there was a huge measure of Israeli security arrogance and ignorance that meant that they weren't looking for the threats right under their nose, right over the fence, as it were. And they had reports about a short Yemenite, curly-haired Jewish suspect, somebody who they be concerned about. And the intelligence marked it and passed it over. And so allowing Yigal Amir to be at the rally at Kings of Israel Square on December 4, 1995, and after this extraordinary rally saying yes to peace and no to violence, and a huge anthem at the end singing the famous Shir LaShalom, the Song of Peace, only moments after that, he was gunned down from behind.
I mean, it's just, it's so tragic. I mean, it's very powerful. But that play is unfortunately, I wish it would run a lot longer. It's unfortunately done, but please talk about Ari Roth, your upcoming productions in these Voices from the Middle East, if you would.
Right. I mean, we've got three other presentations coming up, two of which are big deals in terms of all that we're investing. Four nights this week, Najla Said, the daughter of Edward Said, a wonderful author and performer on stage and screen, has created together with an extraordinary performance artist and sound artist, Judith Sloan, they've created Imperfect Allies, Children of Opposite Sides. And they take a friendship that they've really cultivated between them and explore the ruptures that October 7th has caused within their respective communities and within their own close relationship, how you process all these traumas that move you into a sort of tribal crouch and often take you away from where you were trying to work to go in your peace building work. And they have been activists on many fronts. The traumas of October 7th and the catastrophes, the atrocities of in Gaza put so much pressure on these artists to actually try, the first impulse is to shut up and turn away and shut down. And they determined to work their way through in asking that question, how far back do we want to go to excavate the origins of our conflict and to find the framework for building something lasting and positive that looks like justice, that looks like peace, and that looks like a cessation to the calamities that are unfolding every day, even since the ceasefire. So it's a show that uses music and poetry and spoken word and lots of dialogue. And the amazing thing about it is just how incredibly strong the script is. I mean, these are wonderful performers and they're doing the right thing and talking to each other, but I wasn't expecting such a sharp and sharply observed script as when I finally went up to see the play this fall, booked it, and here we are with four performances beginning Thursday night through Sunday afternoon. We're even doing a peace cafe with my old friend Andy Shalal at Bus Boys and Poets, a free event on Sunday morning, the 14th of December at the Bus Boys on 14th and V. So that's important to just keep these initiatives going with all the difficulties. Again, it's so easy to turn away from each other. Andy and I have experienced all those dramas. Then in January, we do A Piragon, the brilliant novel by Colin McCann about Bassam Aramin and Rami Elhanan, founders of the Bereaved Parents Circle, who each lost daughters to political violence, to terror, to IDF aggression. And they have created their own dynamic partnership to keep their memories alive and the hope of peace alive as well. So that's January 8th through 11th, also at the church on 16th and S Street.
Wonderful. I mean, this is compelling stuff, folks. We've been speaking with Ari Roth, founding artistic producing partner of Voices Festival Production. Check them out, and thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for keeping hope alive, David.
Really appreciate it. Thanks to our wonderful engineer Mike for his expertise in coming at Don't Forget the Blues with the amazing Lady Murr. And thank you so much for listening. I'm Dave Rabins. Stay tuned. Don't touch that dial. Appreciate you being with us. Take care.
Thank you to everyone who supported WPFW on Giving Tuesday. Your generosity helps keep independent, listener-supported radio strong. If you weren't able to give earlier this week, there is always time. Every contribution at any level helps sustain the music, culture, and progressive voices you hear on WPFW every day. Our end-of-year drive begins Sunday, December 14th. For listeners with IRAs, this is also a reminder that year-end required minimum distributions are approaching. A qualified charitable distribution may be a meaningful way to support WPFW while meeting your RMD. However you choose to give, thank you for standing with Community People-Powered Radio. Please call 202-588-9739 or visit WPFWFM.org to learn more. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a community town hall on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. Our theme is Free Airwaves, Fighting for Community and Public Radio. With the economic upheaval caused by DOGE, the social stress exacerbated by the military occupation of the Capitol, and the harm inflicted on innocent people by ICE agents, it is more important than ever to have an independent grassroots media focused on building communities, amplifying marginalized voices, and driving social movements. The town hall takes place on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. at the Brookland Bus Boys and Poets, 625 Monroe Street, Northeast in the district. Additional information can be found online at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building community one broadcast at a time.
Mutual aid, the act of taking care of each other, comes in many forms. One such form is supporting WPFW. At a time when so many are hurting, if you are doing well financially and want to do good, we invite you to give the gift of WPFW. Emancipatory media is truly the gift that keeps on giving. A tax-deductible donation can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org or from Sunday, December 14th through Saturday, December 20th, during our pledge drive by calling 800-222-9739. It is your continued support that allows us to do the work of building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.
Hey y'all, I am Jaren with Dreaming Out Loud.
And I'm Ron Motu with the Go-Go Museum and Cafe. This holiday season, Historic Anacostia is bringing joy from December the 11th through the 22nd.
A celebration filled with daily surprises along Marion Barry and MLK Jr. Avenue Southeast. Christmas tree lighting, live concerts at the Go-Go Museum, and holiday meals and deals from your favorite Anacostia businesses.
12 days of festive family fun as you dine, shop, and explore DC's Arts and Culture District. Powered by the Anacostia Bid, artsagogo.org. For more information.
Inviting all D.C. hand dancers, Philly boppers, Chicago steppers, Carolina shaggers, and West Coast swingers. The Treehouse Dreamers venue offers dance music from Motown and more every Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. at 4722 14th Street Northwest. DJ Jammin' Dave and other fine DJs provide an atmosphere offering seniors socialization while getting much-needed quality movement through familiar tunes and dance every Friday. Details at 301-922-4064. That's 301-922-4064. WPFW offering wellness through dance, one activity at a time.
I'm Weezy Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.